This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Logan Shannon in for Virginia Prescott. Shining seas, amber waves of grain, purple mountains' majesty, America the Beautiful presents a vision of the nation as a kind of utopia, a wide, varied terrain of rustic beauty where men and women roam free and good is crowned with brotherhood. But the reality of America's open spaces is far from utopian, and the land is not free to all. In fact, visitors to America's national parks are overwhelmingly white. According to a 2011 report from the National Park Service, only 7% of annual park visitors were African American. So, what accounts for the discrepancy? In her book, Black Faces, White Spaces, Carolyn Finney delves into environmental history and cultural studies to find out why the story of the American outdoors is so white. Carolyn Finney is assistant professor of environmental science, policy, and management at the University of California, Berkeley. She's also the chair of the Relevancy Committee for the National Parks Advisory Board. This is her conversation with Virginia from last year.
Well, that 7% number really hit me. What does it reveal, however? Simply that African Americans are not visiting national parks, or do they have a different relationship to the parks and nature in general?
I think it tells us something more about, you know, who we are as a country, that it's important to understand that the national parks don't exist separate from all the issues we have had both historically and in the present having to do with race and difference, the struggles that we continue to have, you know, to talk and relate across that difference. The parks aren't separate from that. So in many ways, it's like I'm always surprised when people are surprised by that statistic. But if I were talking about something like the criminal justice system and bringing up race and ethnicity and difference, people wouldn't be surprised. Mm-hmm. The parks are no different. We have a complicated legacy in this country, even in terms of how the parks were founded in this country. We have to understand that when the parks were founded in this country, there were people living in a lot of those places. There were Native people living in a lot of those places that had to be removed. I have to be really careful, right? I'm not trying to paint one group of people as being bad and another group of people as being good. I actually don't find that to be a useful conversation. What I'm trying to point to is the complexity. So when someone tells me that statistic, like you said, 7%, the first thing that it points to is the complexity of our history, the legacy of that history, and what that looks like today.
Well, let's look a little bit at that legacy. How far back do we need to go to understand the African-American relationship to the environment?
So what I would say is, and those who've heard me say this before, you know, I went to, a couple of years ago in Detroit, I went to the Charles Wright Museum. And at the present, the Charles Wright Museum has the largest permanent exhibit of African-American history in the United States. And that'll change because the Smithsonian African-American Museum is being built as we speak. And I tell people, when you come into that, when you look at the trajectory of African-American history as represented by the museum, you kind of start off where you're at the gate of no return in West Africa, mm-hmm. you know, imagining yourself as an enslaved African. You're suddenly walking into the hull of a boat, and the way the museum has it set up, it's two stories. So the first story is supposed to be the deck of a boat where you see images of white slave owners with the whips in their hand. And if you go below deck, you see representations of black bodies like sardines lying on shelves next to each other. And then once you walk through the hull of the boat and you're on the east coast of the United States, and the first image that you see of an African American on American soil, it's an auction block, and then you see an image of an African American toiling the land, working somebody else's land. So that's how far back you have to go if we really believe in the roots of our past. And yes, in some ways, it's very African-American, but it's all of our history in this country.
And at the same time, you know, there was this sense of expansion, you know, in American history.
Yes.
The move out west, you know, there was, that's where the promise was. The Homestead
yes.
Act, you know, you can
yes.
have land if you just work it. So,
well, who the you is what's in question.
Right.
Who
if
could
you're
have land?
A European or you're an American of European descent, not
yeah.
an African-American, certainly not a Native American, certainly.
Right.
But I'd like to just move forward to your own relationship with the land, your family's relationship with the land as you were growing up, where your father was a steward working the land for somebody else.
Yeah, and I want to say that both my parents were. So my parents were originally from Virginia. They grew up poor, high school education in a small town called Floyd. My father went off to the Korean War. And when he came back from the war, like a lot of black folks, you know, at that time, in the 40s and 50s, who were living in the South, he said to my mother, they got married, and said, let's move north. We'll have a better opportunity as black people in terms of getting a job. And so he came up to New York. And he basically had two job options. He could be a janitor in Syracuse, New York, and Syracuse is about 5 hours north of New York City, or about 30 minutes outside of the city, there was a 12-acre estate owned by a very wealthy Jewish family called the Tishmans. And for anybody who's ever been to New York City, there's the Tishman Building. They own a lot of real estate in New York City. And they needed caretakers for that estate. They needed a couple to live on that estate full-time, 12 acres, swimming pool, lake. So my parents took that job. This was in Westchester County. And so we lived in the gardener's cottage on that property. During the week, it was like our own private park playing. We played outside all the time. You know, we could play outside. This was like in the 60s and 70s, right? But we were also in a very wealthy white neighborhood. So I tell people that Schaefer, who of Schaefer Beer, lived next door to us. Wingfield Golf Club was about a 3-minute walk around the corner. So this is a very wealthy white neighborhood. We were the only family of color in that neighborhood. I still remember some of the stories, me and my brothers. I mean, I loved the idea of playing outside. But I also tell people, I remember when I was 9 years old, walking home from school one day, and you always had police patrolling the neighborhood because there was so much wealth in the neighborhood. And, you know, I was really unimpressive. You know, I had a little afro, my little reading glasses, my little school bag. And I got stopped by a cop right around the corner from my house. And he said, where are you going? And I gave him the address. And he said, oh, do you work there? And I was 9. And I'm thinking, dude, I live there. But, you know, I'm not saying that out loud. So I just said, no, I live there. And I remember being really confused by the fact that he thought I worked there. And going home and telling my parents, and my dad then called the police station and really gave him a hard time about that. And then they never stopped me or my brothers again. That's the kind of stuff that's embedded. And this is the conversations we have in a lot of different circles today around race and difference that come up all the time.
We're talking with Carolyn Finney, who's the author of a book called Black Faces, White Spaces. It's about challenging the ideas that we have about the relationships between African Americans and the great outdoors, be it camping, be it adventuring, be it environmentalism. Carolyn, I'd like to address some of the stereotypes about black people in the outdoors here. We have a clip here from the black media web series Black Folk Don't. Now, this is from the Black Folk Don't Camp episode.
Camping? I just don't see it.
You can't really generalize to say all black folk. Most of them, though, don't camp. Because out in the woods with the bugs and all that stuff. For some reason, we don't like animals. We don't like wild things. We don't like things that we can't control.
We don't like campsites. We don't like tents.
I wouldn't, for the most part, do it unless, I guess, I had like some protection on me.
I was in the Boy Scouts, and I didn't want to go camping. Camping is not in our blood.
Carolyn, you had an experience of living outside. I mean, to what extent are these stereotypes actually perpetuated, but within the African-American community?
So I think that's a great question, because I am a person who believes that we all have agency. And what I mean by that is we all have choice. But as someone, as an African-American, as a human being, as a person, I like to feel like I do have some choice in my life. And I first of all, I don't speak for all African-Americans, and I need to say that, too. I also understand that, you know, collectively, we have worked over time to define who we are for ourselves. There was a period of time in the 60s, in particular, when it was about black as beautiful, black power, and it, you know, it was a beautiful time. And two black psychiatrists wrote a book called Black Rage, and they talk about, it's great, our ledge grew, you know, in terms of who we could be as black people. But they also asked the question, have we also shrunk our ledge? So if you love French cinema, or let's change it up, if you love to camp, are you black enough?
Mm-hmm.
Is that a black thing to do? But in listening to those comments, yeah, you know, there's some truth to the fact that some black people don't like to camp. You know what? Some white people don't like to camp as well.
Right.
But it doesn't change the fact that we all have a relationship with the environment and the outdoors. If you are breathing, you have a relationship. I don't care if you live in the country, in the suburbs, or in the city. You know, we stand on land, we breathe air, we eat food, we engage with it either consciously or unconsciously every day. One of the things that was really powerful to me is when I was interviewing Black people, that many of them, when I would ask them things like, how do you define environment? Or if I say parks, what comes to mind for you? Or I would say, tell me your story about the environment. Some of them would say, I don't have a story. And I would, of course, go, everyone's got a story. And at the end, a few of them would say to me, no one's ever asked me that before. And for me, that's where the power was, that no one's ever asked them about their own story.
Well, historically, have visits to national parks been a white thing because African Americans may have been even barred from entering a park?
You know, at the core of the national parks, you know, and I think there was some really good intention and ideas and bigger dreams about what this country means and how we want to represent ourselves. And we do have these extraordinary places like the Grand Canyon. I think there was something really pure and good. But it doesn't exist separately from all the realities of all the violence that took place around a lot of those lands and on those a lot of those lands, to understand the violence that continues to take place around a lot of those lands, to understand that you have groups of people from various walks of life that are still fighting over their right to engage those spaces in the way that they believe is appropriate. So the parks don't exist separately. The parks, just because... there's another story that I like to tell about during the civil rights, because you had all these beautiful parks, but segregation was also happening.
Right.
Right? It didn't change just because it was a national park, you know, even though at the core, the national parks are trying to do something really good, I believe. One of the stories I think I write about in the book is that there was a white professor out of Boston, sort of early 60s, late 50s, early 60s, who wanted to go visit Fundy Bay National Park, which is just over the border in Canada. Mm-hmm. And he wanted to take an African-American couple with him. And he knew that this was, you know, during the time of segregation, Canada's just right over the border. So he wrote the folks up, the superintendent, the folks up at Fundy Bay, to say, you know, I just want to let you know I'm bringing this African-American couple with me. You know, I want them to be treated with respect. I want them to have a good time. When he finally got a response back from the Fundy Bay National Park, the folks there, they said, you know, we're really sorry. We can't promise you that they'll be treated well because we get a lot of American visitors here. And then we find out that the people he wanted to bring there were Dr. Martin Luther King and his wife, Coretta Scott King, who wanted to take a break from the civil rights movement, you know, take time to write all the things that Howard Zanizer and others who are creating the Wilderness Act at the same time the Civil Rights Act was taking place. All those ideas that I really believe they would have said, yes, absolutely, that's what you should be able to do. But they couldn't even do it across the border.
Well, but how about today? I mean, are environmentalists and conservation groups accountable for the lack of diversity?
There's a dominant narrative, right, about how we think about and have thought about the environment and the outdoors in this country. A lot of mission statements are grounded in that dominant narrative. And what that dominant narrative doesn't do is address the complex histories for people like African Americans and other non-white peoples, where it doesn't look all nice like that. It wasn't about John Muir being able to go into a park and talk about why we need to preserve this space, because he doesn't really talk about the fact that Native people had to be removed in order for that to take place, and that John Muir also looked down upon African Americans. And I'm not trying to diminish John Muir. What I'm trying to say is the man was a human being who was flawed, who lived in a country that, you know, that strive to take on and engage this idea of democracy, which I think is amazing, and how difficult that was, and I believe is and still is. When you talk about engaging all the different kinds of people with our different beliefs, our different ways of living, our different ways of showing up, and outdoor spaces are not immune for that. They're not separate from that. So it's not, for me, it's not about everybody showing up at every national park, right? But there is something about, you know, I believe national parks are key to telling the story of who we are. I think it's important that not only that we visit the parks, but that we can also work at the parks. It's also about employment. Who gets to have a job? Who gets to be a superintendent? Who gets to decide what narratives and stories are told? What does it mean for a young child? Let's say a young non-white child, for instance, to come to a park and see somebody who looks like them and imagine, hey, maybe I could do this job. You know what I'm saying? I mean, sometimes we make really simple decisions when we're really young based on what we see and who is represented and where we think we might be welcome and how we might consider something we never considered before, like being in the outdoors. But there's multiple ways to engage the great outdoors. There's multiple ways to engage environmental issues.
That was Virginia's previous conversation with Carolyn Finney, Assistant Professor of Environmental Science, Policy, and Management at the University of California, Berkeley. She's also the author of Black Faces, White Spaces, Reimagining the Relationship of African Americans to the Great Outdoors. You'll find a link to more information on the book on our website, wordofmouthradio.org.